tightens his grip on power and surprise landslide victory. And that does it for our show. We have a job opening at Democracy Now! We're hiring a director of development to lead our fundraising efforts. You can find out more at democracynow.org. Apply immediately. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Nermeen Sheikh, Sam Alkoff, Robbie Caron, Steve Martinez, Hani Massoud, Juan Carlos Davila, Pedro Rodriguez, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, engineer. Special thanks to Julie Crosby, Becky Staley, Hugh Grant. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of a dance party benefit for Safer Streets on Saturday, November 7th at 9 p.m. at Crush in Portland. Safer Streets offers free self-defense classes in various easily accessible locations for women in the Portland metro area who are experiencing homelessness, poverty, mental health, or addiction issues, for sex workers, and for survivors of violence or abuse. Safer Streets is queer and trans-friendly and welcomes and meets attendees at their particular needs or abilities. That's a dance party with DJ Aurora to benefit Safer Streets, Saturday, November 7th, 9 p.m. at Crush, 1400 Southeast Morrison Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the We Real Cool film series at the Clinton Street Theater. This month is the amazing Nina Simone, showing Thursday, November 19th at 7 p.m. Nina Simone was one of America's true musical geniuses. With her unique signature mix of layering folk, gospel, classical, pop, and African music, along with a revolutionary vision of Black freedom, pride, and defiance. Again, that's the amazing and revolutionary Miss Nina Simone, showing as part of the We Real Cool film series on Thursday, November 19th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The time is 5:01, and you're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 Community Radio. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the League of Women Voters of Portland, presenting Coal and Oil Transport, Business Boon or Public Liability. This civic education program takes place Tuesday, November 10th at 7 p.m. at the Multnomah County Building Boardroom, located at 501 Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard. More can be found online at lwvpdx.org. Coming up next is the evening news.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Northern Ireland almost legalized gay marriage.
An Inspector General's report is raising questions about a $43 million gas station built by the Defense Department.
And TransCanada has asked the State Department to withdraw its permit application for the Keystone XL pipeline.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, November 2nd, 2015. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Callie Mikhail. TransCanada, the company trying to build the Keystone XL pipeline, has reportedly asked the U.S. State Department to withdraw its permit application for the project. The Wall Street Journal first reported earlier today that TransCanada was suspending the federal approval process while the company undergoes a review by the state of Nebraska. TransCanada filed an approval application with the Nebraska Public Service Commission in early October. The company is seeking eminent domain authority to build their pipeline on 60 pieces of privately held land in Nebraska, in spite of objections by the landowners. The state commission is expected to have a decision in 7 months to a year. The project had faced stiff opposition at the federal level, and it was expected that the administration would reject it. Pulling the application leaves the project in limbo until after the general elections next year.
The heavy rainstorm that hit Portland on Saturday caused the Portland sewage system to overflow and spilled raw sewage into the Willamette River. The rainstorm also flooded several streets in downtown Portland and caused the MAX train service to suspend several routes. The Portland sewer system carries both rainwater and raw sewage and received a multi-billion dollar upgrade that was completed in 2011. Prior to the overhaul of the sewer system, any rainfall over 1/10 of an inch would cause a release of raw sewage into the Willamette River. It now takes over 1 inch of rain in a 24-hour period before raw sewage is released directly into the river, reducing spills from over 50 per year to less than 5 per year. Saturday's rainfall, while not a record, did dump almost 2 inches of rain on the Portland area.
The Oregon Department of Environmental Quality has issued large fines to two Portland area companies for water pollution violations. The Tualatin Area Natural Food Company, Pacific Foods of Oregon, was fined more than $30,000 for discharging wastewater containing food particulates into the Hedges Creek wetlands on at least 8 different occasions. The Oregon DEQ fined the Swan Island Shipbuilding and Repair Company, Viger Industries, for discharging industrial pollutants into stormwater drains. Viger Industries was also fined for failing to build a biohazard retention treatment facility, as was required by its operating permit issued more than 2 years ago. DEQ testing showed that the stormwater discharges from the plant consistently exceeded legal limits. Viger Industries was in the headlines in August of this year for their contract repairing an icebreaker ship for Shell Oil to drill for oil in the Arctic. That ship was delayed several days by activists whose river blockade prevented it from leaving the dry dock of Viger Industries.
The historic Gasco building south of Portland's St. John's Bridge has stood for its last Halloween. The spooky remnant of Portland's industrial past will be going through the final stages of demolition beginning today. Although it's one of the city's most prized architectural achievements, it's also quite toxic, and the land it's on is now heavily polluted. Built in 1913, it's been abandoned since 1956 when the Portland Gas and Coke Company left the plant once natural gas was piped to the region instead of gas from oil and coal. Officials say they tried to hold off raising the building for nearly 2 years to give preservationists the chance to raise around $2 million to save it.
A journalist in Eastern Oregon has filed a lawsuit against the Baker City Police for retaliating against him for writing an article critical of them. Brian Addison, 50, a former reporter for the Record Courier, claims the police chief and other officers retaliated against him for his journalism, harassing him, making false accusations against him, and forcing his dismissal from the newspaper where he worked. For more, KBOO's Ken Jones spoke with Kristen Hilton and Clifford Davidson, Addison's lawyers, who are based here in Portland.
You filed a lawsuit last Thursday in U.S. District Court in Pendleton against the Baker City Police Department on behalf of journalist Brian Addison. What's at the core of the lawsuit?
The core issue of the lawsuit is that Mr. Addison is a journalist. Back in 2008, he was he was a journalist at the Record Courier in Baker City. And this lawsuit is really about the freedom of the press and the retaliation that he suffered after he published an editorial critical of the Baker City Police.
And that editorial apparently was about, of all things, an Oregon 1A state girls basketball tournament game in Baker City. The police brought a drug-sniffing dog there. What was the gist of the editorial? Was pretty much he was criticizing the use of a drug-sniffing dog, right, at the game.
Right. So he said that it was a violation of the Fourth Amendment, the right to be free from unreasonable search and seizure. And at the time, there was actually a controversy in Baker City about new legislation involving gun rights and specifically ammunition. And people were sort of discussing the Second Amendment and rights under the Second Amendment. And as I recall, Brian wrote an op-ed saying, hey, what about the Fourth Amendment? Why aren't we talking about this and what just happened at this basketball game?
And then the very next day, the editor of Brian's paper was visited by the police chief of Baker City.
Right.
And the police chief demanded a retraction. For what reason?
Yes, it's our understanding that the police chief demanded a retraction because...
Presumably because he didn't like being criticized.
Oh, okay, so there was no legal reason for that. It was, I mean, this was a perfectly legitimate editorial, freedom of the press and all that, which is First Amendment. The paper then refused to retract the editorial, but they did make some concessions to the Baker City Police.
They published a clarification basically saying that Mr. Addison's editorial was expressing his opinion and was not necessarily that opinion of the paper. However, the clarification did make it clear that the Record Courier editors were supporting Mr. Addison and his right to express his opinion.
After the paper refused to retract the editorial but did make some concessions to the police, a few months later the ownership of the paper changed and Addison was fired. He then began working as a reporter in Enterprise for a different newspaper. Was he still subject to police harassment then?
No. He was, as it states in our complaint, you know, the editorial was published in 2008. The police harassment of Mr. Addison began shortly after that. When he took the job in Enterprise, I believe that was 2010, and while he was in Enterprise, there was no harassment by the Baker City Police.
Okay, and then he returned to Baker City after that job, got a new job in Baker City in 2012 at New Directions Northwest, which is a nonprofit. They provide drug and alcohol addiction services and treatment. And the Baker City Police apparently got involved again.
So basically what happened was someone called from the police, suggested that there were facts in Brian's background that made him unsuitable to work there, told the person that he spoke to at New Directions that she should look into his background, which apparently she did, and then they relied on that information to terminate his employment. I mean, there's two things here, right? There's the inaccuracy of the fact file, and then there's this suggestion by whoever called from the police department that there was something about his past that made him unsuitable to be working there. Sort of two prongs to this defamation claim, at least that's one of the claims that we make, that they're suggesting something about him. And when that's being suggested by a law enforcement officer, you know, it might make you think that there's something in his past that's so outrageously bad that he shouldn't be working at a drug and alcohol center. But that's obviously not true. And the document that they pointed the New Directions person to doesn't indicate that at all.
And the even though the editorial, going back to the very beginning of the core of the lawsuit, the editorial that ran in the Record Courier was almost 8 years ago now, are the same officers still employed by Baker City Police Department, specifically Chief Wynn Lohner and Officer Wayne Chastain?
Yes.
We've been talking with Kristen Hilton and Clifford Davidson, attorneys with the law firm Sussman Shank in Portland. This is Ken Jones with KBOO News. The Bureau of Land Management in Southern Oregon began rounding up hundreds of wild horses today, despite protests and challenges from critics. Wild horse advocates are calling for a stop to one of the largest roundups of wild Mustangs in Oregon history. Around 1,500 Mustangs will be rounded up and lifted by helicopter from the Bates Butte area where they've lived for centuries to government-holding pens. From there, the horses will be sold. The areas where the horses live is near Lakeview in southern Oregon. The federal government claims that the horses are overgrazing the land. They want to reduce the wild horse population to less than 100. Last week, the American Wild Horse Preservation Campaign presented a petition signed by nearly 20,000 people opposing the BLM's plans to round up the wild horses. On Friday, the Interior Department Office of Inspector General released the results of an investigation that found the BLM illegally sold more than 1,700 wild horses to a Colorado rancher who sold the horses for slaughter in Mexico. Current law prohibits the BLM from destroying healthy wild horses and from selling wild horses to anyone who intends to sell them to slaughter. However, the BLM has recently indicated that it will seek to overturn the congressional slaughter ban.
The Chipotle fast food chain closed 43 of their restaurants over the weekend in Oregon and Washington due to an E. coli outbreak. Public health officials in both Washington and Oregon determined that at least 22 people eating at six different Chipotle locations were sickened over 10 days between October 13th and the 25th. Upon news of the outbreak, restaurant managers voluntarily closed 43 Chipotle restaurants located throughout the Pacific Northwest. This is the third food contamination outbreak to hit the Chipotle fast food chain since August. The earlier cases involved the norovirus and salmonella.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with author Mira Suramanian. He'll be speaking this evening at Powell's on Hawthorne about her new book, A River Runs Again, India's Natural World in Crisis. This will be followed by Labor Radio at 6, Of the Working Class, By the Working Class, and For the Working Class. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Ruth Kovacs interviews Eric Rise, Iron Tribe case manager. As a formerly incarcerated person, he tells of his prison experience and finding employment with Iron Tribe upon release. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather? Showers. Mostly cloudy with a low around 45. Chance of precipitation is 60%. Tomorrow, 40% chance of showers, mainly before 4 p.m. Otherwise, mostly cloudy with a high near 55. Today in history, in 1983, President Ronald Reagan signed a bill creating the Martin Luther King Jr. federal holiday. And in 2003, Gene Robinson was consecrated as a bishop of the Episcopal Church, becoming the first openly gay priest to reach that office. The quote of the day is from Bishop Gene Robinson, who said, "Far from undermining marriage, gay and lesbian couples seeking marriage for themselves are perhaps the institution's best friends. At a time when marriage is seen as less desirable and less necessary, for straight couples, gay and lesbian people are lining up at town halls and church doors to participate in this traditional and long-standing institution."
The town of Grays Harbor, Washington, is potentially the site of three crude-by-rail terminals. A draft environmental impact statement has been prepared for one of the projects, but it's recently come to light that the scoping comments submitted by several groups that oppose those terminals have been omitted from the draft EIS. KBOO reporter Doug McVeigh spoke with Kristen Boyles of the group Earth Justice to find out more.
First of all, three oil terminals in Grays Harbor? Did I get that right?
It is an astounding number, but yes, in the Grays Harbor area, which are really the towns of Hoquiam and Aberdeen, and West Shore, bearing at the edge of the harbor, there are three proposed crude oil terminals, which would amount to billions of gallons of oil being shipped through Grays Harbor every year.
Now, this draft environmental impact statement, is that for just one of these terminals, for two, or for all three?
Yeah, it's a little confusing. There are actually two very similar draft environmental impact statements out for two of the three projects. The third project is a little bit further behind, and we haven't seen that yet. What has happened, though, for these first two is that during the review of these very lengthy and technical documents, people began to notice that their particular comments and their particular concerns that they had submitted during an earlier public comment process were just left out. And it's more than just sort of being upset at having your comments not listened to. It was that these were raising substantive issues that needed to be addressed in these documents, and they just don't seem to be there.
Could you go through some of the comments and some of the folks who are not being reported on in this EIS?
Well, the Washington Dungeness Crab Fishermen's Association and the Oyster Growers Association for that area were the first to notice that their issues had not been included in what's officially called a scoping report. When they brought that to attention 5 environmental organizations who are opposed to these terminals, including Washington Environmental Council and Climate Solutions. Their comments were not included. And then, you know, astoundingly, the comments for the Quinault Indian Nation, which have treaty rights to the fishing and shellfish gathering in that area, their comments as well were not included in the scoping report in the draft environmental impact statement.
Okay, now this is a draft environmental impact statement. The final statement, is it possible to get these scoping comments into the final, or is this process going to have to start over? What can be done?
No, sure, there's a way forward. The first way forward is to make sure that all of these things are as transparent as possible. Everyone's scoping comments and everyone's later comments should be available on the website for these projects, and they're not. And that would have allowed people to much earlier see that something's missing. And so first we got to get a handle on public transparency and to make sure that these comments are available up online now and then up online as comments come in the future. And then second, the groups are asking that once the scoping comments that were omitted are available, that there be an extension of the overall comment period so that people can look at them and say, oh, wait, here's an issue that was raised and yet it hasn't been fully raised in these draft documents, so that they can be addressed in the final. That's precisely what we want to have happen.
Now, again, forgive my confusion, but 3 projects, how many is this? Is the same problem occurring on the other EISs, or is it just for the one on the one project?
It occurs in both EISs that we have out right now. Both are out for comment. The third project is not as far along, and so we aren't at that stage yet. I suspect after this mistake, which has now been brought to light, the third one will not have this problem.
Well, hopefully so. Now, the deadline for commenting, I saw that one of them at least has been extended till November 30th. What's going on with that?
That's right. The comment period for both has been extended till November 30th. And people who are interested and have things to say about this comment and the increased rail traffic through Washington and the increased oil tanker vessel traffic through Grays Harbor should go and submit those comments to the Department of Ecology and the City of Hoquiam before the November 30th deadline.
Just to give people an idea of the scope of the issue, how many rail cars, how many gallons of oil are we talking about?
Each of these terminals will be serviced by one or two trains a day of crude oil. Those are 1.5 miles. 100 car trains coming in full of crude oil every day through various communities down the Chehalis River, and in fact, across Washington from Spokane, to be unloaded in huge storage tanks at the shoreline in Hoquiam, and then loaded onto marine vessels, oil tankers, oil barges, and out through the Grays Harbor estuary and bar. And that continual traffic, let alone the risk of an oil spill and fire, is the major reason for the opposition to these terminals.
So now, where can people go to find out more about what's happening there in Grays Harbor and about the work that you're doing?
There is a group of groups that have gotten together called Stand Up to Oil, and Stand Up to Oil has a website, and if you go to their website, then that would be a good place to find information.
Terrific. Well, again, I've been speaking with Kristen Boyles. She's a staff attorney at the Northwest Regional Office of Earth Justice. Kristen, thank you so much.
Thank you. Appreciate your interest.
This is Doug McVeigh with KBOO News.
It's 5:23, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
If you're a presidential aspirant and you have to tell people you're a person of integrity, chances are you're not. These odds get worse if you have to hire someone to attest to your honor. How intriguing, then, that a spokeswoman for the Bush campaign was recently trotted out to tell us that, quote, Jeb's record is one of integrity. Her testimonial was necessitated by the still evolving news story that, after leaving the Florida governorship in 2007, he immediately cashed in on his name and state government contacts. Bush III became a richly paid legislative consultant and board member to major corporations that had received lucrative benefits from Florida's government while he was at the helm of it. With cynical chutzpah, Jeb the presidential wannabe now campaigns as an ethics reformer, piously preaching against the corrupt coziness between moneyed interests and government officials. But in the last 8 years, Preacher Bush has pocketed at least $18 million in personal payment from his own quiet spends through the revolving door of government corporate corruption. Only 4 months out of office, for example, Jeb got a nice sinecure as a board member of the insurance giant Tenet Healthcare, which ran several of Florida's private hospitals under the state Medicare program. In 2006, Tenet was found to have cheated patients and taxpayers with more than $1 billion in overcharges. To settle this malfeasance, the corporation paid only $7 million. Meanwhile, Tenet recently gushed that it has benefited greatly from Mr. Bush's, quote, extensive background in government service and his perspectives on public policy and social issues. In heartfelt gratitude, during the past 8 years, this one corporation alone has put more than $2 million in Bush's pocket. This is Jim Hightower saying, can the guy even spell I-N-T-E-G-R-I-T-Y? Integrity?
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at LaborRadio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Striking Amazon warehouse workers at California's Cal Cartage Warehouse are heading back to work after a brief strike last week. The week of strikes and picketing by port truckers and warehouse workers at the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach was capped by $3.5 million in new wage theft claims filed with California's Labor Commissioner. Warehouse worker Anthony Velasillo says that striking workers will present a petition to the bosses and come back to work with community support to end their strike on Monday.
We will give a petition signed by all the co-workers that we are going back to work. They are supposed to let us back in by law. And not only that, we are going to have support from the community, other organizing members from other organizations, as well as the Teamsters. And we are going to push to make sure everybody goes back to work right away.
Velasillo says the warehouse workers' struggle at the ports is for a living wage, decent working conditions, and the right to form a union. He says working conditions inside the warehouses need to be improved along with the wages.
We work in our butts off all day. They want you constantly just breaking your back for them. Started to implement a heat break, which they've been trying to deny us. We've been taking it little by little, but they've been getting hassles about it, writing up and intimidating us. Not only that, some days, there's some areas where it's really unsanitary. Our lunch breaks where we have to eat, it's right next to our containers, right next to the forklifts where all the smoke. It's just horrible. To tell you the truth, infested with rats as well as roaches.
Drivers at XPO Logistics, Intermodal Bridge Transport, and Gold Point Transportation have ended their strikes. Pacific Nine transportation drivers remain on strike indefinitely. According to a group called GPAC, part of Chicago's gun violence problem is the availability of guns bought by straw buyers who make gun buys at suburban dealers and then give the guns to criminals. GPAC is an organization formed to counter the influence of the gun lobby in Illinois. The group filed suit to try to get suburban dealers to crack down on straw purchases. GPAC Executive Director Kathleen Stances says the suit resulted in one of the communities, the Village of Lyons, passing an ordinance to crack down on the straw buys.
GPAC's focus is really getting illegal guns off the streets. We don't look at this as a violation of the Second Amendment. This is simply keeping guns away from criminals. We have, since our inception 2 years ago, put together a coalition of 50 policymakers up and down the state that we have endorsed who already are committed to enacting this kind of public safety regulation that will protect our families and communities.
For more information on GPAC, go to GPACIllinois.com.
Brought to you by the IBEW, 750,000 men and women powering the way for an American comeback. Information on how to become an International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Power Professional is online at IBEW.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit LaborRadio.org.
The White House Budget Office released its annual report today, including a decade-long study on the cost-effectiveness of government regulations. The report found that the financial benefits of regulations far outweigh the costs. Over the past 10 years, regulatory protections have generated over $800 billion in annual benefits, with as little as $57 billion in costs. That means the benefits outweigh the cost by more than 14 times. In response to the report, the Center for Effective Government said that if the politicians who complain about the federal government's role in regulating corporations were driven by logic, evidence, or reason, this debate would be over. Public Citizen said that beyond the economic benefits, there are numerous other benefits of government regulation of industry that are difficult or impossible to quantify. The group said the emotional toll of a slow and painful death from overexposure to silicon or life-threatening asthma attacks from excessive pollution have an emotional and physical cost that's worth far more than the monetary benefit. Even so, an account that Public Citizen says is systematically skewed against public protections, the benefits exceeded costs by 14 to 1.
The city of Colorado Springs has agreed to drop the charges for hundreds of homeless and poor people who were arrested for panhandling. A letter filed by the American Civil Liberties Union challenged the city's practice of arresting and imprisoning people for up to 90 days for holding a sign asking for money or help. In response, the city has agreed to drop all charges against the 175 people arrested for panhandling this year. In September, and again in October, the ACLU had written the city arguing that Colorado Springs was wrongfully enforcing its panhandling ordinance, prosecuting homeless and impoverished people who had not been breaking the law. In an investigation, the ACLU found that police, prosecutors, and judges had been using the law to punish people who had been holding signs, a First Amendment-protected activity allowed under the Colorado Springs Ordinance. According to the ACLU, the city's practice had resulted in poor people being fined and imprisoned for as much as 90 days under circumstances that could not be legally or morally justified. In other Colorado cities in recent weeks, including Denver and Grand Junction, police have stopped enforcing the anti-panhandling ordinances in response to a U.S. District Court decision that targeting houseless people for holding signs is a violation of the First Amendment.
Northern Ireland almost legalized same-sex unions earlier today. The Parliament of Northern Ireland approved a gay marriage bill in a close vote. The opposition, led by the Democratic Unionist Party, then filed something called a petition of concern. The petition argued that the new law did not have sufficient cross-community support. The Northern Ireland Parliament is a regional body within the United Kingdom, but these petitions are based on the power-sharing agreement between nationalists and unionists. Either side's allowed to file a petition of concern if they feel that the Catholic or Protestant communities in Northern Ireland don't fully support a piece of legislation. This move by the unionists makes Northern Ireland the only part of the UK which has not legalized gay marriage.
A vandal was caught on camera this weekend attempting to break a glass door at the Islamic Center in Omaha. This is the second time the center has been attacked this year. In the security video, a masked man is visible creeping up to the door, making multiple attempts to break the window, then spraying graffiti on the walls of the mosque. The graffiti reads USA, repeated about 20 times around the sides of the mosque. The head of the mosque said he believes the attack is a hate crime because the person came at 3 in the morning with their face masked and they had obviously prepared to carry out their crime. This is the first time the security cameras have caught vandals in action at the Islamic Center. Members of the Nebraska mosque say they are concerned that the next time this man comes back, he'll come when families with kids are present. The FBI is investigating the previous attack as a hate crime, and leaders at the center say they're considering doing the same for the attack this weekend.
The organization Physicians for Human Rights has today welcomed the American Psychological Association's request that the U.S. government withdraw all psychologists from national security interrogation roles and from Guantanamo Bay and other detention settings that operate in violation of international law. The group urged the Obama administration to comply with the APA's new ethics policy and to close Guantanamo and end indefinite detention. For more information, KBOO's Callie Mekiel spoke with Sarah Doherty of Physicians for Human Rights.
So your group, the Physicians for Human Rights, has long called for an end to the torture program. Do you think this move by the APA to withdraw their psychologists is a result of the campaign by your group and others?
Yes, the APA's decision to ban psychologist participation in interrogations, as well as working at Guantanamo and other detention sites that operate outside of, you know, the Constitution or international law, is really the product of a decade-long struggle by Physicians for Human Rights and many others in the psychology and human rights community to push for these changes. And some of our allies in this have been the Coalition for an Ethical Psychology, Psychologists for Social Responsibility, and many others.
What took so long, almost 9 years, for the APA to make these changes and withdraw their participation in the torture program?
That's a really good question. You know, it's a little hard to speak to the motivation in the face of what's really been overwhelming and accumulating evidence, which Physicians for Human Rights and other organizations have really put forth, showing that the APA's policies endorsing psychologist participation were permissive of abusive interrogations, as well as, you know, work to show that the cooperation of senior APA officials with U.S. government officials tied to the torture program was producing these permissive policies. I guess what I can say is that the reporting of, you know, New York Times reporter James Risen, mm-hmm. and the really dedicated advocacy by a very large movement of psychologists and activists ultimately persuaded the American Psychological Association to initiate this independent review by former federal prosecutor David Hoffman. And he was able to confirm what Physicians for Human Rights and other groups have been saying, which is that these policies were really coming from a place of secret cooperation with people who had a very vested interest in making sure that psychologists could continue to effectively put a seal of approval on abusive interrogation practices. But what we should really also focus on is that there's still another 112 men who remain unjustly detained at Guantanamo. The overwhelming majority have not been charged with any crime, and over half of them have been cleared for release, many for, you know, 8 years or so. And, you know, it's really important and critical for President Obama to fulfill his commitment to close Guantanamo, mm-hmm. and the men who are being held there need to be prosecuted or released as international law requires. You know, there needs to be apology and remedy for the crime of torture, which does include indefinite detention, such as been practiced at Guantanamo. There needs to be, you know, addressing the psychological and physical consequences of these human rights violations. And, you know, most importantly, there really needs to be accountability for these practices. Justice is critical so that victims can begin to heal, but it's also a part of the United States' legal obligations. You know, the prohibition against the crime of torture is really fundamental.
Thank you so much for your time. I've been speaking with Sarah Daugherty from Physicians for Human Rights. This is Kelly Mikhail from KABU News. The Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction reported today that the United States paid nearly $43 million to rebuild a gas station in Afghanistan. The facility was a compressed natural gas automobile filing station in the city of Shebergan, Afghanistan. It was part of a project intended to take advantage of Afghanistan's natural gas reserves, which the U.S. Geological Survey estimated at nearly 16 billion cubic feet, along with deposits of oil and natural gas liquids. The contract to build the station was originally for just $3 million when it was awarded in 2011. Yet the report states that by the time the station was completed in 2014, construction and initial operating costs had gone over $12 million in direct costs and $30 million in overhead costs. A feasibility study 10 years ago found that building a similar station in Pakistan would have cost just over $300,000. The Defense Department was unable to provide any documentation whatsoever to the Inspector General about the cost of building and operating the station. The department even claimed that it was no longer able to find anyone who knows anything about the Task Force for Stability and Business Operations, which was the program that had commissioned the station, a fact that the Inspector General found both surprising and troubling. The task force, which reported directly to the Office of the Secretary of the Defense Department and had a budget of about $800 million, was closed down in March of 2015.
And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Monday, November 2nd, 2015. One youth killed and at least eight others injured during Israeli attacks targeting West Bank communities. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Israeli soldiers shot and killed on Monday morning a Palestinian teenager and kidnapped another near Al Jalama military roadblock northwest of the northern West Bank city of Jenin, allegedly after the two attempted to stab soldier. The slain Palestinian, Ahmed Awad Abu Rob, 16, was killed after soldiers stationed on the military tower opened fire on him, while resident Muhammad Mahmoud Kmail, 17, was kidnapped. The soldiers closed the roadblock on both directions and initiated a search campaign in the area. On Saturday, soldiers shot and killed Mohammed Tal Nazal, 17 years of age, on the same roadblock. According to Palestinian sources, 74 Palestinians, including 12 children, 2 infants, and a pregnant woman, were killed since October 1st. Also on Monday, Israeli soldiers injured 8 civilians in the village of Katanna near the central West Bank city of Ramallah. Moreover, many residents were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation. The clashes in Katanna started after Israeli soldiers attacked protesters at the entrance of the village. Protesters marched in the funeral of 2 youth from the village that were killed by the army last month and only handed their bodies to their families on Sunday night after detaining them for 20 days. Moreover, Israeli soldiers invaded early on Monday several Palestinian communities in the occupied West Bank, broke into and ransacked homes before kidnapping 13 Palestinians, including children. In other news, Israeli soldiers demolished on Monday 3 Palestinian apartments in Nusaybe neighborhood in Beit Hanina town in occupied Jerusalem. Early on Monday, the army demolished another home in Jabal al-Mukabbir in Jerusalem. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Monday, November 2nd, 2015 news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
While fighting continues to rage in Syria, negotiations between Russia, the United States, and several Mideast regional powers, including Iran, were held in Vienna last week. No accord was reached, but the sides agreed to meet again in mid-November. Amid the peace talks, President Obama announced plans to deploy several thousand U.S. Special Ops troops to Iraq and Syria to fight the Syrian military and the group known as Daesh, with the English acronym ISIS. Iraq responded by saying the country does not want or need any new U.S. troops to be deployed to Iraq. U.S. Congress members have also challenged the president's unilateral extension of the war in Iraq into Syria. Normally, a declaration of war must be approved by Congress before sending troops abroad. There are currently more than 3,000 U.S. troops in Iraq conducting raids and training Iraqi forces. Last month, Iraq reached an intelligence-sharing agreement with Russia and Iran, essentially bringing Iraq into Iran's sphere of influence. Over the weekend, Russian fighter jets conducted more than 200 bombing raids against the rebels fighting the Syrian government. The main front of the war is now at Aleppo, Syria's largest city, that has recently been controlled by the Islamic State. Aided by Russian airstrikes, the Syrian government is slowly regaining control of the city. The gains made by the Syrian government has caused former enemies, Al-Qaeda and Daesh, to join together to fight the Syrian government troops, who are aided by Iranian troops and soldiers from the Lebanese militia Hezbollah. Most experts believe that if Syria can retake Aleppo, it will essentially have regained control of the country. In other Mid-East news, a Russia civilian airliner carrying more than 222 people broke up in mid-air and crashed in Egypt, killing all aboard. Daesh immediately claimed responsibility, but Russian authorities have refused to comment on a possible cause for the plane crash, only saying that the plane was too high to have been shot down by a surface-to-air missile, as claimed by Daesh. The initial investigation points to either a mechanical failure or a bomb placed on board the plane prior to takeoff.
After enduring months of bombing by U.S.-backed fighter jets from Saudi Arabia, the people of Yemen are bracing themselves for another kind of attack. Cyclone Chapala is the second strongest storm ever recorded in the Arabian Sea. It's set to make landfall tonight in Yemen, where coastal cities could receive up to 8 years' worth of rain in a single night. Yemen, like most parts of the Arabian Peninsula, has an extremely arid climate and gets very little rainfall, but tonight the country's being hit with its first ever cyclone. A cyclone's a tropical storm known in the eastern U.S. as a hurricane. In the northwest Pacific Ocean, these storms are called typhoons. But all three terms refer to the same kind of weather event. A rotating storm resulting from warm tropical oceans and cooler, moist clouds above. These conditions can create some of the most violent storms on the planet. A similar unprecedented storm hit Mexico's west coast in October as meteorologists warn that human-induced changes to the climate will lead to more frequent and more violent storms than any previously recorded.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Don Zur, Callie Mikhail, and Ken Jones. The producer is Doug McVeigh. Special thanks to Robin Ryan. Our engineer is Danielle Parks. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs